best books for the 20th century? As I said, we've gotten this question from many subscribers for many years. The challenge was always, how do you distill so many books that I love down to a few? And finally, I invited John Rappaport to do this with me. It's always so much fun to do it with John. He and I just finished a series, Let's Go to the Movies. Part one was movies, and then part two was documentaries. And if you haven't heard those, they're wonderful, and they dovetail with, you know, great ways of learning the kind of knowledge and content that, that either we're going to be talking about tonight or that dovetails with what we're talking tonight. Tonight is part one. We'll do part two later this summer. That means John and I are going to choose a total of 10 books, five each on each part one and part two. So I'll choose 10, John will choose 10, and we'll each present of our 10, five on each night. So John, are you with us?
I am.
Great. Well, welcome. To be here. I can't wait. We're very excited about your joining us monthly, and I know I talked with you earlier a little bit about what you're going to do in the first one that we'll post at the end of July. Maybe you could say a little bit about it.
Yes. I'm going to do a presentation called Inside the Medical Matrix. And I've written a number of articles in the past that cover various aspects of this. It's impossible to really give it a complete treatment in one evening. So I might end up doing a part one and two, we'll see. But the idea is to take people as far inside the false science behind what I call the medical cartel or the medical matrix, and reveal certain things that will be useful to people when they approach medical matters. As an investigative reporter since 1982, I found myself gravitating into that area without really ever knowing why. But the further I got into it, the more fascinating and troubling it was. And so I've ended up over the last 30 years writing a great deal about that. And I would say the difference between this presentation and others that people may have heard or read is that what goes on inside laboratories, inside the research, inside the public health agencies like the CDC and the World Health Organization is absolutely staggering. And when I began to discover that, when I wrote my first book, AIDS, Inc. in 1988, I knew that I was going to have to pursue that because nobody else seemed to be doing it. So that's just a little hint of what's to come.
When I was looking at Bloomberg tonight, reading about Moody's announcement that it had dropped 15 banks or dropped the ratings for 15 banks, over on the right in the top articles, there was something that says, that a headline that implied bird flu was rising up again. And I said, oh, my, this is a plan.
A plan. Yeah. They've been trying to push that one lately, you know. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it is. Yes. Yeah, another phony epidemic.
Here comes the bird flu again.
Yeah, right. Look to the skies.
Well, before we start on our five books each, now, my impression is you read quite a lot. Is that fair to say? Tell us about
Yes.
your relationship with books.
I do.
You do?
I do. I'm reading all the time. I mean, whenever I'm not writing, I'm reading.
When you're not writing a book, you're reading a book. Well, and you've written some absolutely fantastic books. Okay, so let's just dive right in. We have five each, top books to help you navigate the 21st century. You're the guest, John, so you need to go first.
Okay, well, let me just say how difficult it has been, I know, for both Catherine and me to winnow this list down. In fact, while you were talking in the first few minutes here tonight, I thought of two more books that I couldn't understand how I'd possibly left out. So it's really impossible, you know. I'm
right.
going to be hemming and hawing and juggling and so on. But I'm going to start with Politics in Healing, which is the name of a book by Daniel Haley, H-A-L-E-Y, who is a former New York State Assemblyman that I got to know in several interviews after I read his book. I can't remember who gave me the book or how I came upon it, but it is the most fantastically well-done presentation of suppressed cancer cures that I've, and it's interesting to read, and it's exciting. There are chapters, you know, there's a chapter on Gaston Naissance in Canada with his cure called 714X. There is a fantastic chapter on a medicine that I had never heard of before I read the book called hydrazine sulfate, pioneered by Dr. Joseph Gold, whom I believe recently died. And really an extraordinary summary of Dr. William Frederick Koch, K-O-C-H, and a homeopathic medicine called glyoxylide, and what happened to Koch as a result of his research and treatment of patients with cancer in the 1930s, going into the 1940s. He was subjected to three trials. The FDA brought him to court twice, failed to win a prosecution against him. The Federal Trade Commission then followed up, and still a little confused about the outcome of that trial, but it didn't look like Koch actually lost, but he was just literally hounded out of the country. He left the United States in 1950, moved to Brazil, and lived there for the rest of his life, treating cancer patients. The stories of people who have recovered from cancer using this medicine are quite astonishing, as well as his treatment of farm animals. And you will find in that chapter on Koch in Politics and Healing a statement that was read into the congressional record by Senator Langer from North Dakota, which is actually a magazine article on Koch, which indicates that Canadian farmers in Victoria with their animals were having tremendous success using this homeopathic remedy for all sorts of animal diseases, and that farmers in Michigan were up in arms about the fact that they were not permitted to use this medication, and that they were not waiting for FDA approval or anybody to approve. They were just going ahead and doing it because it was so effective. And then, I mean, Dr. Koch was slammed from pillar to post because, of course, as with any homeopathic remedy, the authorities that be would say, we've analyzed this and found it to be totally useless because it's nothing but water. Since that's what homeopathy does. Yeah, I mean, they just keep diluting things down to the point where you're really basically left with an energy signature of the substance that you began putting in water. And since this completely overturns the whole idea of modern drugs, which are delivered on the basis of impact, you know, adverse impact, it couldn't have turned out any other way vis-a-vis the authorities. They would have had to say this, otherwise they would be admitting that there was a completely different paradigm to the entire approach to treating medical illness. Chapter after chapter, Hoxie, the story again on hydrazine sulfate, I wrote an article that basically summarized that chapter. It involved Bob Guccione and Penthouse Magazine and his wife, Kathy Keaton, who was diagnosed with cancer and was treated with hydrazine sulfate and appeared to make a complete recovery from it. It involves a trial, a clinical trial that was done at the National Institutes of Health. Finally, they said, okay, we'll try it out. But they used a bogus protocol. And one of the dangers of hydrogen sulfate is when people are taking other medications at the same time, especially tranquilizers. And according to Haley's chapter, every patient in the study, the government study on hydrogen sulfate, died. And all of them were on tranquilizers. And Guccione wanted to mount a lawsuit against the federal government and was asking for volunteers to join this class action suit. Kathy Keaton, who is cancer-free, his wife, then goes into the hospital for surgery that apparently was for something completely unrelated and rather routine, and dies. And the press paints this kind of ominously, implying that it had something to do with her unorthodox treatment for cancer. So those are just some of the highlights. I mean, this book blew me away, and it's very conversational. I have never read a book on suppressed medical technology that was so easy to get through and yet so informative at the same time. Haley did a brilliant job. So that's my number one.
You know, you probably haven't read Mary's Mosaic yet.
Not yet.
There's a theme in Mary's Mosaic where Peter Janney is talking with the daughter of one of these enforcement guys who was both in the CIA and the Washington PD and the mob. And, you know, he's got like 20 different badges. He's one of those covert players. And she describes all the different things her dad taught her, and Janney kind of uses this as a theme to teach people how things really work. Does it in a very effective way, but one of the things the guy says is, you know, how one of the common ways of getting rid of somebody is just when they're in surgery for routine something, you just off them at that point, and everybody thinks it's natural. I read that, and I said, well, yeah. I mean, if you talk to people who've been playing with the spooky guys in the medical field, you'll hear that. But it's the first time I ever saw it outside of, you know, a back room with medical people. So it may have been connected, John.
Yeah.
Is all I'm saying.
I mean, I assume that it was, because Guccione at the time was very passionate about this whole thing, and he had published a big article by Jeff Kamen that Daniel Haley got a lot of his information from about hydrogen sulfate. And this big article appeared in Penthouse. This was before Kathy Keaton died. And so, you know, this was a national magazine. It was, Kamen's article was wonderful. It was filled with facts and so on. And so there was really a ripple that went through the cancer establishment.
Bill Cosby used to have a routine on medics, and he said that the life expectancy of a medic from the time he hit the water to the time he almost got to the beach was 7 seconds. And every time I read a story about a doctor who discovers a cancer-curing, non-pharmaceutical solution, I can hear that in my mind,
mm-hmm.
that he's just shortened his life expectancy enormously. Okay, well, my first book is one that we did on the Salieri Report in September 2009, and it's called Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why by Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence Gonzalez was a reporter for one of the magazines in the National Geographic Group, and he was writing about wilderness experience, and he went to the editor and said, look, we're writing all these wonderful stories that make it seem like it's absolutely wonderful to go out into the wilderness and traipse around. But, you know, it can be dangerous. And we have an obligation to tell people that, you know, things can go wrong. And so he persuaded the editor to let him write a story about, you know, people who survive extraordinarily dangerous wilderness experiences. One of the reasons he did this was as follows. His father had been in World War II as a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot. He was a pilot. And his plane got hit, and so he parachuted out, and his chute didn't open. He fell to the ground and lived. And it was one of the things that triggered an interest in Gonzales about who survives these extraordinary experiences that you're not supposed to make it through. Well, it turned out that that first article was wildly popular and successful. And so he kept going, doing more and more research. And finally, after researching and writing up all of these extraordinary wilderness survival experiences, he pulled them together into a book called Deep Survival, Who Lives and Who Dies and Why. And in the book, you go through these experiences. And Gonzales just happens to be an absolutely fantastic writer. When you read it, John, you're there. You can't put it down. You're on the cliff. You're hanging by your fingers. You're scared to death. I don't know. You know, it's unbelievable the intimacy that he takes you into, and you literally feel like you're there. It's spellbinding. But then what he does is he brings it back to what he calls 12 rules of survival. And the amazing thing is that these are 12 rules of survival that can help you not just in the wilderness, but in any aspect of your life. And whenever, if you've ever been in a difficult situation, and I know that you and I have been in difficult situations, and you want a methodology for being successful no matter what the world throws at you, this is a fantastic book. It really fits its name. It's really about deep survival, and everyone can use it. These are lessons in life that are really, you know, they are richly delivered and richly useful. And I think for a period where things are changing as much as things are, and life can throw you a lot of unexpected curveballs and wild cards, this is a wonderful book, a beautiful book, and one that you certainly, you know, will find amazingly entertaining and really enjoy reading.
Wow.
Deep Survival. Okay, next up.
I developed a rule of my own, as I just remembered as you were talking here. 1961, I had hitchhiked out to Los Angeles to live, not knowing anything about Los Angeles. I had a friend out here that I would eventually stay with, which I did, in Hollywood. And at that time, of course, you know, if you lived on the East Coast, you knew nothing really about the West Coast. I mean, it wasn't like it is now. They were just tremendously different worlds. And so I came from New York.
Oh, I remember. I couldn't, when I first came out to Stanford and somebody said hello to me and used my first name without permission, coming from Philadelphia, I was in a state of shock for 24 hours.
You want to reach for your gun, right? yeah, I mean, that's part of the thing. And the other thing was that Los Angeles was like a cemetery. And there was nobody around except for people in cars. And coming from New York, it was just, you know, a shock that I couldn't handle. And you couldn't walk around in Los Angeles. I mean, you still can't. I know a guy who lives in Europe who recently came to L.A., and he's a big walker. And he said, you can't walk in L.A. He said, you start and you're so discouraged by the time that you walk half of one of those huge blocks that you just feel totally fatigued and you have to go home, which was my experience. Whereas in New York, you can walk for 6 miles and, you know, because there's people, there's things to look at, there's all kinds of stuff, and you don't even know how much territory you're actually covering. So anyway, I was down to something like 37 cents to my name, and I had just come from shooting pool in a pool room in Hollywood during the day because I had nothing to do and I had no job and my friend was at work. And I was walking home to his place, which was about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles away, but seemed like 100 miles. And I thought, what am I going to do with my life? And the only answer I could think of was keep walking. That became one of my survival rules. Just keep walking. You know, would I make it back to his apartment so I could cook up some popcorn? You know, because that's all I was eating then. And I said, well, that's the rule. You have to keep walking. It's worked. It's actually worked at various times. Anyway, okay, so number two. I'm going to throw you a couple of curves here because I just have to substitute. Because you reminded me of Utopia or Oblivion by Buckminster Fuller while you were talking about robotics. and I have to include that, so I'm going to knock out one of mine and bring that in. This is a book that, from a thinker who is so paradoxical in a sense, Bucky Fuller. I mean, he goes so deep into the future and what's possible for humankind, and yet at the same time, in certain respects, is so completely naive about the way the world works that he can just absolutely flummox you as you're reading. But in Utopia or Oblivion, which I think is his most accessible book, he talks about the coming crunch in robotics, in automation, in the fact that industry is going to be able to automate its products to such a degree in the near future that it will throw huge numbers of people out of work, no matter what else is happening in the economy. And that the products, and that the products will be made, you know, more effective and efficiently and cheaper. And so this will be the MO. And what's going to happen to all these people who are out of work? And this is the book in which he says, doing more with less, doing more with less, doing, using technology so that over a period of time, the world is able to produce more for everybody using less natural resources because of improvements in science and technology. And he says that this theme will progress to unheard of proportions. And therefore, there is enough for everybody. If you want to calculate it on a global scale, there is enough of survival, you know, food, clothing, shelter, and then you can also add transport and education for everybody on the planet, no question about it, except it'll never happen in the system that we have now, because the system is not geared as its first priority to provide that. But that is what we're heading for, whether we want to be there or not. And so we have to think about it, and what can we do about it? And his proposal in a nutshell, which is extremely radical, is that everybody who is thrown out of work is automatically put on, as he calls it, scholarship, which means education, free education, unlimited amounts of education. And of course, before the internet, he was talking about libraries, classes, schools, whatever. And he said the first stop ought to be a kind of a 2 or 3 month vacation where the person just sits around and goes fishing or whatever and thinks here and there. And then in his inimitable style, he says, look, if you have out of every million people, one person who comes up with one scintillating brilliant idea to assist the survival of the human race, then the rapidity with which the human race will progress in this system of, quote, universal scholarship and education will be absolutely unbelievable. The thing that he leaves out, of course, is who's going to administer this, this new system.
It always comes down to the enforcement question.
It does, indeed. And this is the puzzle that one you are left to think about when you read the book. And I wrote a number of articles in the early 2000s about this. You know, are you going to leave it to governments to actually provide this system to everybody and do it in a non-punitive way, non-invasive way? Are you going to leave it to mega corporations to do it? And in the process of giving lectures about this, and I'll close here on this, a guy came up to me afterwards and said, you should know that in the early 1940s, Bucky was writing about this for Fortune magazine.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And neither did I. And I looked at this guy and I said, do you realize what you just said? He said, oh, I'm fully aware of it. I said, you're implying that in 1940, which was where he pegged it, mega corporations, of course, who read Fortune magazine, realized that they had a choice. They could go on as they were doing in their usual style, or they could decide that they could actually take a detour and provide all the essentials of existence to everybody on the planet cheaply, very, very cheaply, and make more profit in the long run than doing what they were doing. And they had, therefore, to consciously decide to pursue the path that they were taking, and they still are taking. And he said, that's absolutely the implication. He said, that's exactly what happened. That kind of blew me away. So, highly recommended, Utopia or Oblivion, Bucky Fuller.
Well, you know, if you've ever gone to a Walmart in rural Tennessee, what you realize is it's really a distribution center, and it's being run kind of on a cost plus basis to do exactly that, what you're describing. I was going to mention Fuller's. Have you ever read The Grunch of Giants?
No.
It's one of his last books where he says, you know, we have a problem. We have a tapeworm. You know, they're basically. It's quite amazing. It's a tiny book. It's very thin, but he basically says, you know, these guys are a real problem. Yes, Virginia, there is a conspiracy.
Right.
Okay, so my second book is The Art of War by Sun Tzu. One of the opening lines in The Art of War is, warfare is a great affair of state, the field of life and death, the way of preservation and extinction. It cannot be left unexamined. Now, when I was going through my infamous litigation, I would have some spooky guy get in contact with me, and after we sorted out the fact that the first name he gave me would not be his name, you know, he would then say, oh, you know, I used to work for the CIA covert operations, and here's what I want to talk to you. And then what would come out over a period of, you know, 1 to 3 months was little pieces of advice that I was supposed to be given. And about 5 times the advice was, we want you to read The Art of War by Sun Tzu.
Wow.
And what I finally discovered, John, was that, you know, this is a Bible. Now, here's why, one of the reasons I'm recommending this. You know, we grow up in our lives and we're taught to follow the Ten Commandments and be good and tell the truth. And there is a huge effort, as you know, to get us to engage in the power of positive thinking and to want peace and be peaceful. And nobody says, listen, baby, the fundamental model on planet Earth is war, and you need to understand it and be good at it, or else you can't navigate your environment. And the reality is we're in our fundamental economic model right now is central banking warfare. And war is one of the biggest businesses on the planet. I would say that slavery is an even bigger one. But that can't work without war. And I think it is imperative that everyone take the time to examine, as Sun Tzu says, it cannot be left unexamined. And this book is a very interesting book. Another favorite one of mine is The Prince by Machiavelli. But it's a very interesting study in power and how power can be used. We had on the Solari Report in August 2010, Victor Maher, who's from the University of Pennsylvania, who's done the latest hot translation of Sun Tzu. It's a very interesting interview, and you can go back in the Solari Report archives and get it. And we go through the history of the thing. But one of the things that came out, and it's one of the reasons I recommend this book, if you look at the history of Western military philosophy and strategy, it's very much based on the premise of a world with a bond market. You know, a bond market, John, allows you to borrow a great deal of money and build a huge war infrastructure before people have to come out of pocket to pay for it. You know, by the time the bonds are out there, it's too late, and then they have to come up with the tax dollars. But they never had a bond market in Asia, particularly when Sun Tzu was writing. It was about 400 to 500 BC. And I should mention that the historians believe it was not just one author. It's really probably a compendium. But they talk about strategy in a much more economically efficient model. And the whole idea of, I think there's one great line where he says, you know, it's stupid to think in terms of winning 100 victories. You know, the greatest victory is when you win before you go to war. So it's a much more efficient way of dealing with power struggles, and it's a real interesting treatise on the exercising of power, And I will tell you, we're dealing with a force globally that considers this book literally their Bible. And so if you want to know how many of them think, it's absolutely imperative from my standpoint to read it and to understand it. But study war so there can be war no more.
Wow. Well, I will follow up on this by going to number 3, Plato's Republic. And I studied Plato in college many moons ago. We had to read several of the dialogues of Plato leading up to the Republic. And when I got to the Republic, it was a tremendous shock to me, because suddenly it seemed to me that everything was turned on its head. Plato wrote dialogues, and Socrates, who had been apparently Plato's teacher, was featured as the master interlocutor, the master questioner in these dialogues, these fictional dialogues, in which he would engage with citizens of ancient Athens, you know, bright people, and he, Socrates, would wind them up into untenable positions by using various forms of logic and spurious logic, if you look deeper, into contradiction and absurdity, and showing them that they had never really examined the key concepts of their lives, like or the life of the community, such as justice and truth and the good and all of these concepts. And therefore, the early dialogue seemed like an exercise in freedom and freedom of thought. But all of a sudden, or probably gradually, but by the time you get to the Republic, which is his master work, you are now looking at something completely different. Because, and the reason that I listed this book is because when people devise a system of thought or try to embody the truth in a system, ultimate truth, and it could be economic truth, it could be political truth, it could be any kind of truth, and describe it in those systematic terms, they inevitably paint themselves into a corner. And this is the corner into which, you know, this is the corner of corners into which Plato painted himself, because what he's basically forced to say in the Republic is that the system of truth that he advocates for, which is that perfection in all of its forms exists in another dimension, and this reality that we live in is merely a shadow of that, which certainly has something to be said for. But he takes it to such a point that he's left with only one choice, political absolutism, because somebody has to administer this system, you see, for the community, the city, the polis.
There it is, the enforcement question again.
There it is, you see.
There
somebody
it is.
Has to be in charge of this. Otherwise, it's simply left, relatively speaking, to the devices of everybody to come to their own conclusions. And so here he is abandoning individual freedom completely in the service of perfection and the truth in capital blazing letters. And so now what you get is not a republic, you get fascism. You get the philosopher king. You get the, quote, smartest people running the show. You get the absolute authorities who have somehow found their way into this other dimension, higher dimension, where the perfection of all ideas exists, and then they bring that back into the political structure in order to rule the people. And at the time that I studied this, which was in the mid to late 1950s, Nobody seemed to be concerned about this. Now, since then, people have pointed out what I'm saying here, but I don't think nearly to the degree that it's necessary. But if you read this all the way through, and it's not easy going, but you'll see how it all unravels and unfolds. One minute you're saying, this is absolutely marvelous. And the next minute you're saying, it's absolutely horrifying. And finally, you see what results from this. He has to consider such things as poetry and music. Is this good for the people to be exposed to this? Is this going to put people on the right road? Or is this going to somehow subvert the nature of the state? All of these kinds of considerations. And I can tell you that this is, in a way, a companion piece to Sun Tzu, in the sense that the boys in the back room, I'm talking about the real dome heads now, think about these things. Believe me, they do. They manipulate these things, whether their objective is chaos or you know, to build order on top of chaos. They are thinking about all of these things in terms of the universal solution to it all and how it's going to affect the global management system that they fully intend to put into effect on the planet. So it's required basic reading to really understand the intellectual roots of these people, because they've read it or they've been lectured to about it when they went to Yale. They know it, they understand it, and they support it.
Right. Well, you're responsible to manage. You're responsible to lead. It's inconceivable to you that the livestock can take care of themselves.
Right.
Farmer would never do that.
No.
Okay. So in that vein, moving right from the theoretical into the actual applied. My third book is Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham. It's called Trading with the Enemy, The Nazi-American Money Plot, 1933 to 1949. And in fact, the author died 2 months ago. He just died in April 2012.
Oh, wow.
It was originally published in Doubleday, December 1982. And if you've ever digested the official history of World War II, and you'd like to undigest it and get the actual history of World War II, it's a very fascinating look at how the major American German banks and corporations managed to continue to conduct business with each other and both military industrial complex throughout World War II. And it's really an untold story, I think. I just put a video of Joseph Farrell, who's written a lot on this topic, up on the blog this week, and he talks about the same topic. And there's a wonderful documentary, Council of the Gods, I don't know if you've seen it, that the Socialist Party in Germany made that shows the sort of this backstory on how you had significant corporate ties that were literally profiting and doing everything they could at many different times to keep the war going when it could have been stopped. So the Germans would run out of ball bearings, and every effort would be made by the American corporations to make sure they could get more to them to keep the war going. And it's very well researched and very well written. It does such a thoughtful job of helping you kind of see, it takes you into government and it shows how the different government officials are getting overturned at the highest levels, even coming through the president, because they're trying to win the war. And somebody is reaching, that long hand of the black budget is reaching in from the top and stopping them from doing it, and they get frustrated, and you get into all these different political situations. And that's exactly how it works. And, it's very true to the form of being a senior government official and struggling with that. Those tremendous conflicts of interest that work out through the bureaucracy. But it really shows you a very important picture on the history of multinational corporations. And if you want to understand many of our problems today, it's imperative to look at the money coming out of the Nazi line that, that kept on going. There are people who literally say the Nazis won the war, because you have major Nazi money and interests that continued afterwards in alliance with the Americans. And this book gives you the history of why those stories are not as strange as they may sound if you've digested the official history. So I think if you want to get out of the matrix and really see how the world works, this is a great historical introduction to help you understand a backdrop of what's going on in Europe and the United States now.
Blew my mind completely when I read this book.
Yeah.
I was just beside myself. I mean, and when I told, I wish I could remember this guy's name. He was a substitute host for Art Bell for a little while before Nuri came on board. And I was on with him. I did a whole show on the Oklahoma City bombing. And I mentioned Charles Higham or Higham. And he said, oh, yeah, Chuck, he said, he used to be a friend of mine. He said he used to write about Hollywood. He was like a Hollywood reporter. And he got on to this whole thing, and he couldn't let go of it. And I was just looking for a quote of mine here, because I wrote about this book. But it was about the ball bearings. That was the sentence, the paragraph that just, and it was about ITT. And it said, you know, and he had citations for this. The Germans would not have been able to continue the war without the ball bearings, without ITT providing them to the Nazis. Would not have been able to continue the war. And then you start to think about the numbers of people killed because they were able to continue the war. And this was supposedly a war between America, you know, and its allies and Germany and so on. And obviously it wasn't. It wasn't at all that way. A friend of mine for many years who would constantly say, there's no such thing as a conspiracy. No such thing, no such thing. This is all just incredible crap. He was quite an amateur historian. Sent me this book and he said, this is a book about a real conspiracy. This is real. This is a real one, you know. And I read it, and I just fell off the chair. It's a fantastic book.
Right. It's better than a mystery novel. And the other guy who nailed this was, of course, a more particular story was Edwin Black's IBM and the Holocaust. Because IBM made the software and databases and all the technology to do the Holocaust. Without IBM, it really couldn't have happened on the scale that it did because it organizes around database technology. I have an article called The Data Beast, and I talk a lot about that and make parallels to what's going on today. But, you know, I think it was in that book or this one, you have Dulles sitting in Switzerland laundering money back and forth.
Right.
The Americans and Germans so that they can all keep the war going.
And I have to mention the two other books that are like fallouts from a Trading with the Enemy. About I.G. Farben, the infamous octopus Nazi chemical pharmaceutical cartel that put Hitler over the top in Germany. The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin, B-O-R-K-I-N, which
Amazing
is a tremendous,
story.
Well-documented book. And another one, which is less well-known, but equally important, by Josiah Dubois, called The Devil's Chemists. And Dubois was sent down during the war, I'm going to peg this somewhere around 1942, to Guatemala to do research on the influence of Farben in Guatemala, of all places, and came back. I mean, this guy was a meticulous researcher, as you'll see if you read the book. And in the book, he says, my conclusion was that Guatemala was a wholly owned subsidiary of I.G. Farben. That's just to give you an inkling of the power, international corporate political power of this cartel that existed during the war. And Borkin goes into what happened to Farben at the end of the war, the Nuremberg trials. And my girlfriend late 1950s, her father was Telford Taylor, who was the chief prosecutor of Farben at Nuremberg. Little did I realize the implications of this at the time when I met him. He was a colonel, and he was tasked with bringing Farben executives to trial at Nuremberg at the end of the war. He eventually wrote about this in a couple of books. And his conclusion, I mean, he was pushing for much stiffer penalties for the Farben executives. And basically, the word came down with an iron fist that this was not going to be so, because these were the guys that were necessary to rebuild Europe, and they were
right.
going to be put back in place. And so it was business as usual. I mean, there's a lot around this whole idea that starts with trading with the enemy. And those are a couple of other books. Okay.
Those sound great. I first got onto it because, you know, I grew up in a university setting. My parents were very involved in a university. And you started bumping into Nazis. Because they were all brought in, you know, the agencies brought them in and tucked them away in the foundations and universities. And so, you know, suddenly at a very young age, they were pretty scary. And it got me very interested in what in the world this was all about. Again, many people saying the Nazis won the war.
Which brings up, just trying to type
one.
In here, Operation Paperclip,
yeah.
which was a book. And I can't remember the, let's see, Operation Paperclip. I don't see the author here, but it is a very good account of bringing Nazi scientists of all kinds into America after the end of the Second World War and the connection with the CIA and the OSS. I mean, this is a thread that just never quits. You can take it down
right.
to the present. Okay, to shift gears completely, one of the most hated and reviled American authors in American history, Henry Miller, wrote a two-volume work called The Air-Conditioned Nightmare, which was his name in the early 1940s for consumerist America, or America, however you want to look at it. The first volume was called The Air-Conditioned Nightmare, and the second was called Remember to Remember. These are not, Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn and other books by Miller are called pornographic. They were banned for a while. These books in no way resemble, subject matter-wise, those books. This is a recounting of Miller, who comes back from Greece, where he's been staying with his friend Lawrence Durrell, author, at the outbreak of the Second World War, after Miller vowed he would never come back to America, and he does. And he immediately sets out from New York, which is his hometown, to drive across the country. He has no money. He has nothing, as usual. And he begins a journey with his friend in an old car driving across America. And he describes the people that he meets. And there's a chapter on each person, each encounter, in these two gigantically entertaining and riveting volumes. And the reason I bring this up is because Miller was always drawn to individuals. Individuals who were, so far the mainstream that there was no mainstream. People who were doing completely individual things, who were surviving and living and thriving off the map of everybody else. And at this point in his life, he changes his perspective entirely because he's really almost finished the books that he set out to write, and now he becomes intensely more interested in other people. And he
wow.
writes about a doctor in the Midwest who becomes a painter when he's 80 years old. He writes about a guy who built a pyramid in the middle of nowhere. He writes about an art dealer in Los Angeles who allows Miller to survive by buying his watercolors. It goes on and on and on. In other words, unique individuals who live all over America that nobody's ever heard of. Some of them are writers, but some of them are not. that no one will ever know, or no one would have ever known if it weren't for Miller describing them and meeting them and staying with them and imbibing their lives. And these books are so alive that, you know, I just had to put my life on hold for a couple of weeks when I got a hold of them 20 years ago and read them all the way through. And what it shows you is that everything that we learn from the major media and official sources of information about what America is and so forth is completely, completely upside down. Because right. all around this country, which is, as Miller describes it, gigantic. I mean, he's impressed greatly by how huge the country is as he's driving across it and how much empty space there is everywhere. He says even if it's owned by some giant corporation or the government or whoever and there's fences there, it's still all empty. And there are, in places that we've never heard of, people that we've never heard of, who are so far off the map, living their lives in individual ways and have concocted and invented solutions for their lives in ways that don't line up in any possible way with received wisdom whatsoever. Absolutely not. And this is one of the beauties of these two volumes, and I highly recommend them.
Well, it's interesting because the quote I put on the blog for this week's discussion is from your book, which I adore, The Secret Behind Secret Societies. You say, right. In the 21st century, the challenge will be to decentralize reality. If every human could rise to the level of harnessing his or her imagination at 10% of peak power, at 5% of peak power, the lives of all of us would change radically. We would begin to truly live. A spontaneity of time would occur. And I think that's what you're describing, a distinct world of decentralized realities. Much richer.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Much richer. You know, nobody's diagnosed with anything. You know, oh, this guy's mentally ill because of this and that and yeah, but no. What you have
the
are
grief counselors haven't started Cuisinarting their minds yet.
Yeah, right. They haven't come over the hill yet, you know. in their invading army, with people who, you know, and this to me is what it's all about, you know, people yeah. who decide as individuals, well, this is what I'm going to do. If you were to take Spielberg's movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, remember in the early part, you've got Richard Dreyfuss and there's one or two other artists that are, you know, obsessively building these hills in his living room and out in the yard and all of this is because it's a precognition of the arrival at that spot of the mothership. If you just remove the mothership, all the extraterrestrials, all of that, and you just look at these people, you see, as being people that have a desire to live their lives completely different, and looking at it, you have no idea why they're doing it, but they make it work somehow. They make it work because they're inventing
it
from within themselves.
Now
you have a picture of the way reality could be for millions of individuals were they to take that on. And that, to me, is, you know, that's when you really begin to live, when you find yourself doing that, when you see another person doing that and you learn about what they're doing. And you say, oh, my God. And this is also reflected in Haley's book, Politics and Healing. When you look at these different researchers, all of these researchers are independent lone researchers coming up with cancer cures, you see. They're not involved in any government labs, university labs, or anything. They just figure things out in some way on their own. I mean, Royal Rife with his machines destroying microorganisms and, you know, with vibrations and electromagnetics and so on. I mean, this just comes out of the individual. See? And this is just absolutely intolerable as far as the state is concerned, because were they to allow this power to be unleashed on all fronts, you see, the whole bureaucratic structure, the whole game, the whole, you know, life is war concept would dissolve like sugar and water. It would be all over. So I guess there's a couple of running themes here tonight.
Have you ever seen the cartoon Monsters?
No.
We have two parallel universes, and the monsters finance the monsters get the electricity for their utility from the fear of humans. So the monsters are always running over scaring children, and that gives them more power to run their utilities. So they'd have trouble harvesting us if they couldn't keep us organized. I was going to mention, you know, it's very much the theme of a novel I really enjoyed reading. It was won't be on my list of top 10, was Even Cowgirls Get the Blues by Tom Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
And that was basically the theme of that, you know, sort of unplugging and letting your true nature come to force. Okay, let me give you my next one. And it very much picks up on the Nazi line. And that is Richard Dolan's second volume of UFOs in the National Security State. And Dolan has written a series of books on the whole UFO phenomena, which is, in my opinion, sort of the definitive history of the whole thing. And the interesting thing about Volume 2 is he really follows the money, and he really clarifies the notion of a breakaway civilization, of a group of people who've amassed enough money and enough resources and enough advanced in black technology that they literally have become a separate civilization with separate laws and a separate world. And it's quite extraordinary. And one of the things I always tell people, because it's a rather lengthy book, he does a great summary of sort of the money and the economics and the cultural phenomena in the very beginning of the book and the very end of the book. So if you just read the first and last chapter 20 times and completely digest them, you can almost skip the whole rest of the book, because it's one of the best summaries of this phenomena of the breakaway civilization and how extraordinary it is. It really, and it gives you a framework. You know, the official story is so frustrating, because if you have to talk to people and they're in the official story and you're trying to deal with reality, reality is so different than the official story that it's very time consuming. And the great thing about Dolan's book is it just smacks you right upside the head and puts you into a very different framework, which is in fact the framework we're operating under. And it's very, for me, it's very energizing to have that framework laid out in such a well-written and dispassionate way.
Wow. And he connects this to Nazis somehow, or?
Well, sure, because you have the Nazi technology and money sort of synthesizing with the military-industrial complex at the end of World War II, and they had the flying saucer technology. And that's one of the things that Farrell writes about. And then that integrates in with the creation of the National Security State in 1947 and the passage of the National Security Act and the CIA Act, which in combination with the executive orders allowed the government to issue debt and give the money on a completely non-accountable basis to private corporations, at which they could use to build and control black technology, including alleged the technology that came out of Roswell. So you have a group of corporations able to finance a near infinite amount of highly sophisticated, you know, invisible and other weaponry and technology that nobody knows exists. So you've literally created a non-transparent financial mechanism using the U.S. government and taxpayers' money, and it's literally been able to build an extraordinary infrastructure of, you know, including, my guess, is space fleets and, you know, and UFOs. I'll never forget, I was, when I first saw the documentary Phoenix Lights and saw that enormous spaceship, you know, floating down the side of Arizona, and I looked at it and I said, you know, I bet that's where the $4 trillion went. I bet you Lockheed Martin would charge $4 trillion to build that. But when you add up the money, what you realize is we've literally financed a breakaway civilization. But it's this, you know, the problem, one of the enforcement problems in the United States is that sort of infrastructure of private corporations, defense companies, basically got control of the technology. So the taxpayer is financing them, but the government doesn't control the most advanced technology.
Fantastic. You know, again,
yes.
here's one of these themes, because when I read The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, it suddenly occurred to me, here was Hitler involved in this crazy scheme, which was, we're going to send researchers all over the world to prove that somehow there were these Aryans at one time superior, and we are the descendants of these Aryans, and there was the master race, and we're going to now use genetic technology and breeding technology to come back to being again the master race and so forth. And this is all operating. I mean, he even sent people to Tibet to do research. And alongside this is operating I.G. Farben. And their conclusion that's coming out of their corporate headquarters in this tremendous manic burst of enthusiasm around 1940 is, we will be able to synthesize anything from anything.
Right.
We will be able to do what the alchemists were trying to do. We will be able to take molecules, atoms. We'll be able to produce not just synthetic rubber or synthetic oil for a war effort, but we'll literally be able to transform matter and energy into anything we want to. This is where we're heading. And of course, we'll control it.
Right.
And so this all ties in together, because, as you say, it's completely black budget. It's completely, we have it, we own it, we get the population to pay for it, and we will use it against the population.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right. And you see, when you read the history, you know, I chose Treading with the Enemy, but when you read all the pieces on the Nazi, what they've learned, you'll see a lot of the technology of control is a much more subtle version. You know, they learned how to reinvent it on a much more subtle and profit-making basis. And you see it all evolve out of that, and you see all of these mechanisms evolve out and then through the black budget into all of this stuff. And that's why I think these books are great background to understand sort of what we're dealing with here, because we literally are dealing with a separate civilization. It has become, you know, I said to somebody, if aliens don't exist, we have become as aliens to each other.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a great point.
You ready with your next one?
My last one here is, and I'll just cover this briefly, Philip K. Dick, who authored, I don't know, I think it's 44 novels and hundreds of short stories during his life, science fiction writer. A number of them have been made into movies, Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, et cetera, et cetera. Wrote a novel called Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. And I just list that as an introduction to his work. Dick was intensely aware that the creative artist was inventing worlds and universes, and so were the people running things. Only the people running things were doing it to impose it on everybody else, to invent a reality that they would now say is reality with a capital R, and everybody would buy into it. And he was saying, basically, I should understand how that works because I'm doing the same thing, only I'm writing novels. I'm not, you know, I'm not the head of the CIA. And this novel, Flow My Tears, is a nice introduction to his work. Parallel worlds, parallel universes. He frequently does this in his novels. And the premise here is simply that a celebrity, a world-famous celebrity that everyone would recognize immediately, wakes up in a world, another world, a parallel world, or a different time in the same world, it's hard to say, where nobody knows him. Absolutely nobody knows him. Nobody recognizes him. And that's the beginning of this multidimensional adventure, which many of his novels are. His writing at first can be a little bit off-putting. You're not thinking that you're in the hands of a great writer, but as you turn the pages and as you read the story, you become involved deeper and deeper and deeper into his invention of these multifaceted, multidimensional worlds, and you begin to loosen up your own notion that, you know, we're living in the only reality we are, that exists or that could be, he's not only entertaining, but will drive home many points that will give you pause for thought. So I just use this as an intro to the work of Philip K. Dick.
Okay, my book number 5 is Family Wealth by James E. Hughes, Jr. We did a wonderful Solari report in November 2009 with Jay and talking about the book, and I have a review of it as well up on the blog. It's the full title is Family Wealth, Keeping It in the Family, How Family Members and Their Advisors Preserve Human Intellectual and Financial Assets. One of the reasons I wanted to use this book, John, was I grew up in a world where everything was conspiracies. I mean, conspiracies were the organizing principle of operationalizing anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a group of people would get together and it could be quiet or it could be loud or it could be legal or it could be illegal. But, you know, to me, you got together and you made a plan and then you did it and you were quiet about it. And, you know, but there was this intention, this belief that you could create things or make things go your way, and all you had to do was make a plan and get people together and get on board, and off you would go, and then you'd invent your world. And it wasn't until many years later that I sort of came into this world where people laughed at conspiracies, thought it was a stupid thing to do, and felt that we couldn't invent our world, that, you know, other people had to invent it for us. So, you know, I end this report every week with, if you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. And the beauty of this book, if you look at the core of how wealth works, you know, a lot of people tell me, well, I want my community to be wealthy. Well, then you need the families in your community to be wealthy. You know, we need to build wealth one person and one family at a time. And Jay wrote this book for families that have money and want to preserve it, because it's often the pattern, you know, you create wealth and then it dissipates. And so he built it to help families preserve their wealth. But it's interesting is if you look at, basically he's teaching family how to get together and conspire to help each other succeed. And not just financially, succeed as human beings. It's about, you know, building a family conspiracy to make each other more powerful. It's about gathering energy and power. And the interesting thing is you can take that technology and say, well, you know, I don't get along with my family. Well, create one. You know, create an economic family and start conspiring because it really works. You start getting together and you start saying, okay, what do we do and how do we do it and how can we help each other? And it's amazing, you know, groups of people who conspire together really do gather power and get things accomplished. And I think it's absolutely imperative in this environment where the world changing as much as it is, and the economy going through the changes it is, I really think if we're not in a conspiracy, then we need to start one. So, you know, if it's not your family, start a Solari circle or whatever you want. But we all need to be conspiring if we're gonna build the economic muscle, we need to make it through. Okay,
great.
So those are great. You guys have a lot of fabulous reading ahead of you.
Boy, I'll say.
I promise after the next, after part 2, I'm going to post my runners up. And John, if you feel inclined to, I'll even take a list of 4 million. And if you're inclined to post your runners up, you know, we'd be delighted to do that as well. But I'd like to do part 2 first.
Okay,
and again,
cool.
If you guys have suggestions, please, as some of the questions that came in suggested books, feel free to just suggest and I'll share them with John and post. Now,